We're looking to see if there is some kind of coordinated activity to keep these prices as high as they are.
The state looks at price fixing in gasoline sales. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 13th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a lawyer for Walt Monaghan requests an opportunity to clear his client's name.
It's a hearing that would be aimed strictly at restoring his reputation, the one thing that was wrongfully taken away from him as a consequence of this process.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center opening celebration is October 18th and 19th, featuring big, wild events. Beginning at 10 a.m., free activities for the whole family include live entertainment, an oxygen and octane expo, a street fair along F Street showcasing the new Anchorage Convention District, and Warren Miller Films at the Egan Center. Event information is available online at anchorage.net. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The Department of Law has opened an investigation to determine whether there has been price fixing in the sale of fuel in Alaska. It will be discussed next week at the House Judiciary Committee, holds the second in a possible series of hearings on high fuel prices in the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Department of Law investigation is looking for illegal collusion along the fuel distribution chain that ends at the gas pump. Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen says that, at the least, he hopes to explain to Alaskans why gas and oil prices are still near record levels in spite of the worldwide drop in crude prices. Sniffen says there are limits on what the state can do to help consumers. He says high prices are not illegal by themselves, and there's no law regulating prices or preventing price gouging.
The only time we can really interfere with the way companies price their products, not just gasoline, but any company, is if there has been some kind of price fixing or collusion among competitors to set the price of their products at a certain amount. So that's what we're looking for in this case. We're looking to see if there is some kind of coordinated activity between the refiners or the marketers and sellers of gasoline to keep these prices as high as they are.
As the price of crude oil has dropped, at times nearly 50% in recent months, and consumer prices have gone down in the rest of the nation, Sniffen says that in a normal competitive market, they would have dropped here too. And he got curious about that.
Because when you have a situation where a competitor is able to maintain supra-competitive prices for such a long time, then you have to start asking yourself, is there something else going on here that allows them to charge those kinds of prices? Is there some kind of collusion or coordinated activity among the sellers to do that? And that's what we're looking for.
He says the investigation is made more complex because of various submarkets or methods used to supply retail outlets. For example, Southeast Alaska supplies are barged in from the lower 48. The rail belt is generally supplied by in-state refineries. Sniffen will present some of what he's learned to a meeting next week of the House Judiciary Committee. That panel will take its second look at fuel pricing in the state. Chairman Jay Rammer says that prices have dropped in Fairbanks since the committee began asking questions last month, but not enough. He says gasoline prices in 13 states have decreased to an average of less than $3 a gallon in recent months, but not in Alaska.
I can't explain it. I'm reluctant to call this price gouging, but it certainly is hard for a consumer to draw any other conclusion than that when there is such a pricing disparity between the cost of retail gasoline within the state and the cost of retail gasoline in other small rural states without a great deal of population density.
Ramra says on a global level, demand has gone down considerably, although the cost savings haven't carried over to consumers. The hearing will be at the Anchorage Legislative Information Office on Wednesday of next week. Ramra says he'll continue them on a monthly basis until he sees an effect on in-state fuel prices. Sniffen says he hopes his investigation will be completed by the end of the year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Former Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan is asking for a hearing to clear his name. Anchorage lawyer Jeff Feldman filed the request with the State Personnel Board today. He says Monaghan isn't asking for a monetary award.
It's a hearing that would be aimed strictly and a remedy that would be aimed strictly at restoring his reputation, the one thing that was wrongfully taken away from him as a consequence of this process.
When Governor Sarah Palin fired Monegan in July, she cited a disagreement on the direction the department was headed. But after she became a vice presidential candidate at the end of August, the governor said Monegan was fired because he had a rogue mentality and committed acts of outright insubordination. Feldman says the hearing is necessary to determine the accuracy of those statements.
He does not dispute the authority of the governor to terminate him, either with just cause or with no cause. But what the governor does not have the authority to do is to misstate the grounds for his termination and to defame him in the process.
On Friday, an investigation by Alaska's Legislative Council found that Governor Palin abused her power and state statutes by firing Monegan. Alaska Senator Lyda Green, who is one of the state legislators who pushed for the investigation, says it is uncertain what happens next.
If someone were to take the complaint to the personnel board could take this up as part of their ongoing action. Otherwise, I think it also has the option of going to the attorney general, and the legislature has the ability to address it. But I think that has to be in the same legislative session. I don't think it can carry over to the next year. And so I'm not sure that that's a possibility, because I don't see the desire among legislators to go back into special session again.
Reaction to the report was swift in coming from McCain-Palin headquarters in Anchorage. Palin spokesperson Meg Stapleton fired back that the report exonerates the governor's involvement in the case.
This inquiry was established to investigate one matter. Did the governor act properly in exercising her authority to reassign Walt Monegan? The findings conclude the governor acted within her proper and lawful authority and also offered no further action in the matter.
The Branch Flower Report faults Attorney General Talis Kohlberg for failing to cooperate with requests for information. A state personnel board investigation into Monegan's firing is ongoing. More than 200 people braved some wet October weather Saturday morning to hold a protest in front of the Capitol building in Juneau. Organizers say they wanted to let the world know that not all Alaskans support Governor Sarah Palin's bid to become vice president. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
Some of the homemade protest signs wilted in the wind and rain, and the generator that ran the public address system failed briefly. But organizer Jeanette Lacey says she was pleased with the turnout.
I know it took a lot of courage for some of you to be here today, and that many others would be here if they weren't afraid for their jobs or for the jobs of their family members.
Speakers at the rally attacked Palin's record as governor on issues ranging from climate change and polar bears to health care and gay rights. Attorney Tony Strong said he wanted Native Americans nationwide to know that Palin is not a friend of Alaska Natives.
She is furthering policies that are destructive of our way of life. We have a right to subsistence under federal law. She has challenged that. She wants to reverse everything that the federal government or the federal courts have granted us in terms of subsistence rights.
Vietnam veteran Tom Paddock was one of several speakers to refer to the recently concluded Troopergate investigation. The legislative investigation concluded that Palin abused her power in pushing for the firing of her sister's ex-husband from the state troopers.
We don't need another crooked Alaskan politician representing us.
Supermarket produce manager Tan Nguyen attended the rally. The Vietnamese immigrant says he loves John McCain, but he can't vote for him.
The reason because he's too old for president. He don't know the economy up or down. We can't vote for the guy like that for president.
Most of the crowd was dressed in typical Southeast Alaska rain gear. A few people arrived in costume. One woman wearing a rubber mask said she was a state employee. She declined to be interviewed because she said her voice would be recognized. Another wore a bandana over most of her face. She also declined to give her name.
It's a very political town and it's a very political state. I'm going to be working for a long time to come, so I am cautious.
Juneau Republicans did not organize a counter-protest. Party co-chair Ben Brown says they're busier going door-to-door in support of Republican Kathy Munoz against incumbent Democratic Representative Andrea Dahl. Governor Palin herself spent the day in Pennsylvania. In the morning, she spoke before 5,000 people at a rally in Johnstown, east of Pittsburgh. She attacked Barack Obama's position on abortion.
A vote for Obama would give the ultimate power over the issue of life to a politician who has never once done anything to protect the unborn. And for a candidate who talks so much about hope, he offers no hope at all in meeting this great challenge of the conscience of America.
Saturday night, the self-proclaimed hockey mom dropped the ceremonial first puck at the season opener for the Philadelphia Flyers. As Palin and her daughters, Willow and Piper, walked onto the ice, the Philadelphia crowd greeted them with a mixture of boos and cheers. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the science of sled dog stamina.
They have to have found some way of very, very quickly increasing the capacity to pull energy out of the bloodstream.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Lawyers for Senator Ted Stevens are fighting subpoenas for his wife's emails. Stevens is on trial for allegedly lying on his Senate disclosure forms. It came to light over the weekend that prosecutors are trying to get a hold of hundreds of Catherine Stevens' emails, even as the trial enters its final phases. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The federal subpoena to access Catherine Stevens' emails was issued last month, but only became public over the weekend when Senator Stevens' lawyers asked the judge to quash it. It was sent to her employer, Washington law firm Mayer Brown. The government wants emails between the Stevens couple that have anything to do with property or diamond earrings or gifts provided to the couple and one of their daughters. They also want emails between Catherine and a list of 37 people and companies and emails from Senate offices. Ted Stevens' lawyers are fighting it, calling it overboard and oppressive and a classic fishing expedition that isn't specific enough. They also say communication between spouses is privileged. The court had today off for the federal Columbus Day holiday, and the trial will resume tomorrow as the defense heads into its third day of presenting its case. Stevens' lawyers have released a list of their next batch of witnesses. Catherine Stevens is on the list. Senator Stevens says his wife paid for and instructed the renovation of their Girdwood home and that he had little to do with it. The house is one of the alleged gifts. Also on the list are two men who've been talked about a lot during the trial but have not yet appeared. Contractor Augie Payone, who was paid by Catherine Stevens to work on the house, and Bob Persons, a Girdwood resident who helped oversee the remodeling project. A character witness is expected, Gwen Sykes, who grew up in Fairbanks and worked on Stevens' staff and is now the chief financial officer at Yale University. Also on the list are Helvi Sandvik, president of Nana Corporation, and Ori Williams, who serves on the board of Native Corporation Doyon. The prosecution is fighting one of the witnesses, Billy Martin. He's a Washington attorney famous in the legal community for representing football player Michael Vick, who was convicted of running dogfights, and other sports stars like basketball player Allen Iverson. Stevens' lawyers want Billy Martin to testify about Vico legal documents, but the prosecution says they just want him for star power. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Stevens' case has had a boost recently from an unlikely source, the prosecution. Government lawyers have repeatedly failed to turn over important documents to the defense. The blunders resulted in harsh reprimands from the judge and could have forced a mistrial. Neil Lewis is the New York Times Washington correspondent currently covering the Stevens trial. He says uncovering those government errors has been a strategy of the defense.
I think that's a main pillar of their strategy. I think it's a main pillar of this particular defense lawyer, Brendan Sullivan, who's a very well-known white-collar defense lawyer, and his firm, Williams & Connolly. I think they're sort of known for trying to use those Supreme Court rulings starting in 1963 that require the government to turn over to the defense anything material it learns that could help the defense. And I think they predicate much of their case on that.
Well, the head of public integrity within the Justice Department came over to oversee what was happening with the department's prosecutors. Why have they not been more meticulous in their preparation in such a high-profile case? Is it a lack of resources or staff support, or How could these errors have happened?
I'm not completely sure, but as to the why, one thing, Senator Stevens insisted on a very rapid trial. So things went on in quite a hurry. The other side is the meticulousness and exhaustive research on the part of the defense team. When you sit in a courtroom, there are about four lawyers for the government and four lawyers for the defense at their respective tables. And usually, defense lawyers complain that they go against the government, they're going against, it's an unfair match because the government has this infinitely deep pockets. Well, in this case, and with this law firm trying a big case like this, they're the ones with the deep pockets. They have their four lawyers there, but back at the office, there are just dozens of lawyers going through the documents trying to find anything and looking for that serendipitous moment when they say, aha, this is something they should have told us. We can argue that. So let's bring this up and pound the table about it. And that's what they do.
The judge in this case, Judge Sullivan, used very strong language to describe the government's mistakes, at one time calling it gross negligence. How big do you think the errors really were?
Well, they were not major mistakes, but they should not have in any sense been made. They should have been caught. They should have been disclosed. The government should have had a more airtight case, not a case against Stevens, but a case about whether it complied with all the procedures it's required to do. And it left itself vulnerable. In the end, even though the sharp language used by the judge was out of the presence of the jury, in the end he made a ruling that was quite favorable to the defense. Now, he said in court that he was going to tell the jury that the government, the Justice Department, had deliberately presented false information. When it came time to do it, he pulled back a little bit, but not much. And he did exclude two important categories of evidence from the government's case and told the jury he was doing so precisely because the government had failed to live up to its obligations to disclose. Now, when it comes to time for the defense and Brendan Sullivan to sum up to the jury, I would think that's a powerful piece of ammunition in an argument that says you have to find some reasonable doubt here, because a conviction has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, to say to the jury, well, I hope you have reasonable doubt. You can't believe the government. We caught them at doing something wrong here. So it could be significant.
How close do you think the trial was to being thrown out?
Well, my impression of the judge was he sounded like he was ready to throw the trial, to declare a mistrial, to throw out the charges a couple of times. But he seems to run very hot in the courtroom and then go back and consider things and come out with a more measured decision. I thought it was very close to being thrown out. I had described it as teetering on the edge of a mistrial.
The idea that the case was, as you said, as you characterized it, teetering on the brink of being tossed out, how much does this weaken the government's case?
Well, I believe it's a blow, and what the judge said to the jury is a blow and is something to be exploited by the defense as it winds up its case. However, once a case gets to a jury, and there are 12 people in there, there are 16 people at the moment, he's going to dismiss four of them eventually as alternates, the 12 people in there, it's hard to know how they're perceiving it and what they will do. Traditionally, Washington, D.C. juries are pretty tough on official corruption, pretty intolerant, and like to think they can see through all of this.
Neil Lewis is the New York Times Washington correspondent. An Alaskan serving with the Marines died last week in Afghanistan. 20-year-old Corporal Jason Carella was killed Thursday while manning the gun turret of a Humvee he commanded. His father, Kevin Carella, in Fairbanks, says Jason was filling in for a sick comrade.
They're rolling through an area, and the turret gunner was not feeling well. And so Jason said, well, come on out of there, and he climbed up into the turret, doing an act of kindness for one of his Marines. And because of that, he's not here anymore.
Kevin Carella said says the Army will not tell the family exactly how his son died for security reasons. Corella says Jason was on his second tour of duty overseas. He says his California-based Marine unit was helping to train Afghan national security forces and that Jason called him weekly to talk about his experiences.
And he would say, "Dad, we're making a difference." He said, "The people are trusting us." He said, the people are coming out and telling, you know, about the bad guys and where they are. They're believing in us. He has so many stories, one after another, about working with the locals and the locals thanking them and just making him, he said, "It sucks over here, Dad, but we're making a difference."
Kevin Corella says shortly before his death, Jason survived two shots to the chest because his body armor blocked the bullets. Jason Corella was due to return to the U.S. in about a month, where he planned to get married and start a family.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Though a mid-water trawl survey shows that pollock biomass is down almost 50%, scientists say pollock stocks are not crashing. Jim Iannelli is the National Marine Fisheries Service scientist who is in charge of the pollock stock assessment, which won't be completed and released until next month. He says groups like Greenpeace, who say the fishery is on the brink of collapse, are overreacting.
What Greenpeace is saying about the stock size is just one of the surveys. And it's actually, in that survey, the numbers of fish has increased rather than up. Even though the biomass has dropped, there's new fish coming into the stock. So it's not as gloom and doom as they picture it.
After a hit-or-miss pollock bee season, members of the fishing industry in Unalaska have estimated between a 10 to 20% cut in quota, but official quota recommendations will not be made until next month. Greenpeace Oceans Campaign Director John Hosevar says the quota cut should be closer to 50%.
You know, any way you want to slice it, the problem is that we've been taking a lot more fish out of the Bering Sea than the population can stand.
He says the commercial fishery is endangering species that depend on pollock, like Steller sea lions. The 2009 pollock quota will be set during the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting in December. Inupiaq whalers from North Slope coastal communities are reporting success in this year's fall bowhead whale hunt. Harry Brower is the chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and captain of the Little Kupak crew. He says the season so far has been good.
The barrows landed six. As of today, and we still have the remaining six.
Brower says the hunt will be put on hold for a few days now as Barrow observes funeral services for his uncle Arnold Brower Sr. Harry Brower says the loss of his uncle is significant, not only to the family, but the entire community, because Arnold Sr. is no longer available to give perspective to those who would come and talk to him, accessing a long life rich in traditional culture.
As a young man, hunting, being a part of the whaling community, being part of the reindeer herding days, and being in the military service for many years. I mean, the list just goes on. And being a community leader as part of the North Slope Borough, the Otkavik Inupiat Corporation, the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, all those organizations, you know, he had helped form from the beginning. He had a lot of information and knowledge.
Brower says Arnold Sr. loved being at his hunting camp, and he says although the elder's knowledge of ice conditions and wilderness was extensive, accidents can happen to even seasoned hunters. Arnold Brower Sr. went through the ice last week. He was able to pull himself out of the water, but he did not make it back to his hunting camp. Harry Brower says Arnold Sr.'s family will carry on many of the hunting, fishing, and traditional food preparation methods he taught them. As whaling crews prepare to finish out the season, Brower says weather conditions have been extreme.
It's slowly freezing up in the Elson Lagoon, which is one of our access routes. That access is going to be cut off here fairly quick, so it's going to be having access to the Chukchi site. And hopefully the winds will calm down enough for us to get that access.
Brower says to the east of Barrow, Nuiqsut has had complete success this fall, landing 4 whales to fill their quota, and Coctovic has also filled their quota of 3 whales. Brower says the ice conditions near Barrow are not great. He says large swells make getting out difficult, and there is no ocean ice yet.
It's slowly forming with all the snow coming down, and the young ice is forming out there, the what we call kinyu. It's noticeable out there. It's slush ice, when you translate it into English, that's forming out in the ocean. It's noticeable when you get just past Point Barrow.
Brower says sea ice conditions have changed dramatically in only 2 decades. A veterinary researcher who studies Iditarod and Yukon Quest dogs is honing in on what enables racing huskies to run fast and far. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the goal of the study is aimed at applying the dog's remarkable ability to humans.
Oklahoma State University professor Michael Davis has studied the physiology of racing dogs in Alaska for a decade. While superior aerobic capacity has long been documented in sled dogs, Davis says the latest metabolic research on Yukon Quest and Iditarod dogs also shows them to be extremely efficient athletes.
In a nutshell, they have to have found some way of very, very quickly increasing the capacity to pull energy out of the bloodstream.
Exercising animals use up stored energy first and then begin to tap bloodborne nutrients. Davis says racing sled dogs have the remarkable ability to step up absorption of energy from the blood far beyond what other studied subjects like horses and humans are capable of.
The sled dogs have an additional sort of mechanism or another gear that they can tap into once they start exercising that enables them to get past the factors that normally limit the average human performing endurance exercise.
Davis says sled dogs can increase their uptake of bloodborne nutrients 3 to 4-fold in the span of 2 days of racing, while human and equine endurance athletes require months of training to improve their far more limited ability to do so. The next step for Davis and his research team is to figure out how the dogs do it, and Davis says he's focusing on fat uptake.
Rapid increase in the ability to bring fat into the muscle cell and burn it.
Davis says he suspects fat because rapidly drawing sugar from the blood would likely cause low blood sugar-related problems. Davis will be back in Alaska during the Quest and Iditarod to continue his studies. The research is primarily funded by the military, which hopes to learn how to trigger sled dog-like endurance in soldiers. Davis says his team's work is also attracting interest from diabetes researchers. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A story we ran Friday on the USS Grunion, a sub that sank near Kiska during World War II, mistakenly said it went down August 30th, 1941. The actual year was 1942. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.